From Washington, this is VOA's International Edition. Coming up, the latest on tensions between the Israelis and Palestinians, what Iraqi Kurds want in the middle of the ISIL crisis, a calmer Ramadan in Egypt, plus it is America's 238th birthday. Hello, everyone. I'm Steve Norman. Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke Thursday about this week's killing of a Palestinian teenager.
I unequivocally condemn the murder of a Palestinian youth in Jerusalem a few days ago. The police investigation is ongoing. We don't know yet the motives or the identities of the perpetrators. But we will. We will bring to justice the criminals responsible for this despicable crime, whoever they may be. Murder, riots, incitement, vigilantism, they have no place in our democracy.
16-year-old Mohammed Abdulkader was abducted on Wednesday, and a charred body believed to be his was found in a Jerusalem forest. Abdulkader's family has blamed extremist Jews for killing him in revenge for the deaths of three Israeli teens whose bodies were found in a field in the West Bank on Monday after a more than two-week search. Meantime, the Israeli military has bolstered its forces along the volatile border with the Gaza Strip in response to intensified rocket fire and has deployed its Iron Dome rocket defense system. Israeli defense officials said the deployment includes tanks, artillery, and ground forces. Also, on Thursday, a demonstration took place condemning the escalation of violence between the Israelis and the Palestinians that happened in Tel Aviv. Ruby Demlin was there.
We are the Parents Circle Families Forum. We are a group of Palestinian and Israelis who've all lost an immediate family member in the conflict. We want to stop the terrible bloodshed. We know that the pain of a Palestinian mother and the pain of an Israeli mother is the same pain, and that we have to act to stop this madness and this killing.
Israeli police were still trying to officially identify the body of Mohammed Abdulkader at a forensics lab on Thursday, but his family set up a mourning tent near a mosque in the East Jerusalem neighborhood of Shaul-Fat. Relatives there were preparing a funeral but still waiting to receive his body. The president of Iraq's Kurdistan Regional Government has told VOA the situation in the country has increased the urgency of creating an independent Kurdish state. VOA's Alp Hessen reports.
Peshmerga fighters from the Kurdish Autonomous Region have responded to territorial gains by Sunni militants with moves of their own, taking the disputed city of Kirkuk and surrounding areas. Now, Iraqi Kurdistan Regional President Masoud Barzani tells VOA this is the time to create a Kurdish state.
This is a natural right that must be achieved. Independence must be achieved. I believe now the conditions are also favorable for independence.
The United States continues to oppose Kurdish independence.
No change of policy here. We've said that a unified Iraq is the strongest Iraq.
Mr. President, how are you?
But Kurdish leaders have a strategy designed to make independence more palatable to the United States. Bill Park of London's King's College spoke via Skype.
They want to present themselves as not so much declaring independence from a functioning, ongoing Iraqi state, but being forced into independence as a consequence of the chaos around them.
That was clear in Mr. Barzani's interview with VOA's Persian service.
The situation is chaotic and scary. Now, along a 1,050-kilometer border, we face terrorists and radical groups and people who are unknown to us. This is a new situation. I doubt if Iraq will go back to what it was.
And Mr. Barzani says the past strong opposition to Kurdish independence is no more.
We have discussed this with the United States, with all sides, and with the Europeans. In the past, they reacted negatively, but we don't see that anymore.
Still, Mr. Barzani has to be careful not to alienate his old friends in Washington, new friends in Turkey and Iran, and even some of his own people, says Bill Park.
I think it is a kind of high-risk strategy, but it's a lot less risky now than it's ever been in the past.
Indeed, many experts believe that whatever happens in Kurdistan, Iraq will never be as it was before the Sunni militants took over large areas in the west and center of the country. American political consultant Sam Patton has advised Iraqi Kurds and moderate Sunnis and spoke to Al Hurra television.
The relationship that existed until now between Baghdad and the regions will never be the same. The regions that are no longer under Baghdad's control are going to have to enjoy some degree of autonomy that they haven't seen before.
The militant Sunni fighters now call themselves the Islamic State. Whether they can make that stick remains to be seen, but they may have created the opportunity for Kurds to fulfill their long-held dream of statehood and placed the future of the Iraqi state in question. Al Pessin, VOA News, London.
Iraq's new parliament has ended its first session since April's election, seeking to select, without selecting, a prime minister. Iraqi Prime Minister Nouri al-Maliki has been besieged by growing demands he step down and let the Iraqi parliament select a new prime minister. So far, he has shown no signs of stepping down. Obama administration here in Washington maintains that Iraq must remain unified if it is to overcome the strife that has killed thousands and threatened to upend its government. Meantime, Saudi Arabia reportedly amassing 30,000 troops along its border with Iraq amid growing fears that Sunni militants there are planning to advance on the kingdom. Philip Walter Wellman reports from Dubai.
According to the Saudi-owned Al Arabiya News Channel, the soldiers were deployed after Iraqi government forces abandoned their posts in the border region. The channel said it acquired video showing up to 2,500 soldiers retreating, but a top Iraqi military spokesman described the claim as false news. 4 days ago, the militant group, the Islamic State of the Iraq and the Levant, declared its own caliphate in territory it seized in Syria and Iraq, renaming it the Islamic State. Saudi Arabia shares an 800-kilometer border with Iraq, nearly half of which is adjacent to land controlled by the militant group. The Institute for Near East and Gulf Military Analysis, Research and Consultancy Director, Theodore Karasik, says Saudi leaders are rightly concerned.
At this time, the threat from ISIS seems to be full, that ISIS is gearing up to make further penetration into the kingdom.
ISIL militants are already believed to have a presence in Saudi Arabia. 62 suspects were arrested in the country in May, accused of being part of an ISIL cell. Graffiti supporting the Sunni militants has also been seen on buildings in Riyadh, and pamphlets have begun circulating aimed at attracting local supporters. Recently, the group announced it would like to extend its caliphate from the Mediterranean to the Persian Gulf.
Not only for Saudi Arabia, but also for Kuwait and Jordan, this is a very serious moment because ISIS seems to have the ability to fight and capture territory and carve out areas that they can absorb because they are able to gain the support of Sunni tribesmen who are on the ground.
The deputy director of the Royal United Services Institute of Qatar, Michael Stevens, says the ideology of the Islamic State could appeal to many people in Saudi Arabia and neighboring Sunni countries, especially those that make up the Gulf Cooperation Council.
There's a direct threat to any GCC state in this particular issue because ISIS is not just a bunch of guys running around with weapons. It's an idea. It catches on.
According to Karasik, a large number of the troops deployed by Saudi Arabia to the Iraqi border are thought to be soldiers from the Pakistani and Egyptian armies. U.S. President Barack Obama spoke Wednesday with Saudi Arabia's King Abdullah by telephone about Iraq and recent militant advances. Last week, the Saudi king referred to the Islamic State and saying his nation would continue to face and tackle this scourge. Philip Walter Wellman for VOA News, Dubai.
A teenager from the U.S. western state of Colorado is charged with attempting to aid the Islamic State of Iraq in the Levant. U.S. federal authorities say 19-year-old Shannon Maureen Conley met a Muslim man on the internet who said he was waging a jihad or holy war as a soldier for ISIL. When she told her parents she wanted to leave for Syria to marry the man, her parents refused to approve the travel or the marriage. Connolly told authorities she wanted to wage jihad overseas as a part of her Muslim faith. If she was not allowed to fight, she planned to use her medical training as a nurse's aide to help the ISIL fighters. 1 year after the ouster of Egyptian President Mohamed Morsi, Egyptians are celebrating a much calmer Ramadan. But politics, both local and regional, still weigh heavy on many people's minds. VOA's Elizabeth Arrett has more from Cairo.
In Cairo's Saida Zainab district, Ramadan has taken hold. Whether buying festive lamps or dried fruits for iftar to break the daily fast, people happily mix the festive with the holy.
It represents to us all that is good, prayers and fasting, and of course getting closer to God, everything good.
Yet even as people go about their preparations for the nightly feasts, the suffering of fellow Muslims is never far from some minds. The rise of Sunni militants in Iraq and Syria and the intervention of foreigners leave this shopkeeper unnerved.
May God rescue Iraq from Americans and Daesh and such problems. May God rescue them. Frankly, we are in great pain for our brothers in Iraq and our brothers in Syria.
Ramadan prayers also go to fellow Egyptians, who just a year ago saw a president overthrown and a crackdown on dissent begin. Some are grateful for this year's relative calm.
There's a great difference. At least this year, we are somehow optimistic. Last year, we were in a state of destruction. We could not really feel the taste of what we eat at iftar, truly.
As night falls, some cares fall away. There is, at least on some streets, joy. Family members use whatever they can to brighten their homes for nightly gatherings, living in hope that the turmoil of the past few years will bring a better life.
In fact, it is much better than the last 3 or 4 years, and may God make it a year of blessing on the Arab and Islamic world, like those days we were in Tahrir for the sake of the homeland and its safety. But this year, thanks be to God, we are optimistic.
Elizabeth Arrett, VOA News, Cairo.
News happens around the clock, and VOA brings you the latest at the top of each hour.
This is Joe Palca.
I'm Victor Beatty.
Francis Alonso.
Tune in for a summary of the news at the top of each hour, around the clock on The Voice of America. Hourly newscasts on the radio and on the internet at voanews.com. VOA, a leader in news coverage for over 70 years.
Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko says he's ready to resume a ceasefire in his military campaign against pro-Russian separatists if conditions are met. The Ukrainian president's website said Thursday that he discussed the situation in eastern Ukraine in a phone call with U.S. Vice President Joe Biden. Mr. Poroshenko declared a unilateral week-long ceasefire on June 20th and then extended it by 3 days. Citing lack of cooperation from the rebels, he refused a second extension and ordered new military operations on Tuesday. Meantime, residents caught in the crossfire in the eastern Ukrainian city of Slovyansk say there is nowhere for them to go. Since the 10-day government ceasefire ran out, bloodshed has been on the rise, and residents describe what they saw on Thursday.
There was artillery assault. They fired at us. I was standing right there. The blast was there by the window. The branches were cut off by shrapnel. There were about 5 artillery shots. We hid in the bomb shelter. Thank God there were no human casualties.
And some are choosing to take arms into their own hands.
Half of the factory I work at joined the rebels. They are all normal guys, some with higher education. I've been working with them for a long time. I'll join as well. I'll take a machine gun and we'll keep firing until I'm killed.
Not too far away in the Lugansk region, authorities said at least 9 civilians were killed in fighting that pro-Russian rebels and military forces blame on one another. Kiev says at least 200 personnel have been killed since the start of the conflict, in addition to hundreds of civilians as well as rebel fighters. And then there's the World Cup. Yes, quarterfinals get underway later today, and this is what's going to happen. France will take on Germany, and then Brazil will play Colombia. Then on Saturday, more quarterfinal matches. Argentina plays Belgium, and the Netherlands takes on Costa Rica. Semifinals will take place on July the 8th, and the final match to end the World Cup, that is, for 2014, will be played on July the 13th. A reminder, you can follow all the action at the World Cup on Twitter. You can find us at VOA Football or on the Internet at voafootball.com.
Hello, I'm Carol Castiel, host of Press Conference USA, VOA's weekly newsmaker interview program. Listeners around the globe get insights from authors, analysts, and policymakers on a wide range of topics from U.S. politics and foreign policy to science, culture, and global health. You can listen to Press Conference USA on Saturdays and Sundays. That's Press Conference USA. Every Saturday and Sunday on The Voice of America.
America the Beautiful is a song many Americans know by heart. And while the Star Spangled Banner is the national anthem of the United States, many feel a unique affection for the peaceful, patriotic words that poet Catherine Lee Bates wrote during her journey through the American West in 1893. The gently rousing melody by Samuel Augustus Ward helped to popularize the song, a favorite for holidays such as today's U.S. Independence Day. VOA's Adam Phillips spoke with Lynn Scher, author of the book America the Beautiful, the stirring true story of our nation's favorite song. Adam's report begins with one of my favorite singers.
Oh, beautiful, for spacious skies, for amber waves of grain.
Willie Nelson's version of America the Beautiful is just one of many styles in which the song has been sung. And author Lynn Scher seems to appreciate them all.
This is the song that has always given me goosebumps. I think it is the quintessentially optimistic vision of America. It's hopeful, it's peaceful, and it just feels great to sing.
America.
Scher notes that in each of the song's four verses, Catherine Lee Bates includes something significant about America to celebrate, something to pray for, and some challenge to overcome. In the poem's familiar first verse, part of which is sung here by Eartha Kitt, Bates prays the beauty of the land and its bounty.
The purple mountain.
Scher likes to quote the prayer in the second verse, which says, America, America, God mend thy every flaw.
Imagine understanding that America has some flaws and that we are, after all, still a work in progress. It's a song of pure patriotism, but it's not blind patriotism. She knew we had a ways to go, which of course we still do, and yet she still understood that you could know that and still be patriotic. It's important to understand that we are very complex human beings and it's a complex country. We're not perfect, but we still love it.
That's folk singer and left-leaning social activist Pete Seeger whistling the introduction to his version of America the Beautiful.
Pete Seeger understands and understood about patriotism in a way that a lot of Americans didn't have to. He got into trouble with the law because of some of his beliefs. The very fact that he also sings it indicates that, bottom line, he loves America.
Sure, contrasts the meaning of America the Beautiful with the Star Spangled Banner, a song which also happens to be much harder to sing.
Our actual national anthem, the Star Spangled Banner, was written by a man, Francis Scott Key, who saw a battle, and he was writing about a war, the rockets' red glare and the bombs bursting in air. This one, on the other hand, is peaceful. It's about a land and a country, not about a flag and a war. And it's about a people who are on the edge of greatness, about to be great.
Still, the words to America the Beautiful abound in heroism, as we hear in Ray Charles' iconic rendition of the song, which he began with the third verse.
Oh, beautiful, far heroes proved in liberating strife.
Beautiful for heroes proved in liberating strife, who more than self their country loved and mercy more than life. I think those words are astounding. So did he, obviously. And I must say they resonate more than ever after 9/11. How can you hear the words, who more than self their country loved and mercy more than life, and not think of all the rescue workers who went into the building when everybody else was coming out? It's an amazing thought in that verse, and he does it just beautifully.
But now, wait a minute. I'm talking about America, sweet America.
The Ray Charles version is just so exuberant. It's this kind of bluesy take, which, of course, is pure Ray Charles, very democratic, very American. And that exactly represents Catherine Lee Bates' point of view. And yet he's utterly respectful of the song. This is a poem, and therefore a song, for the common person. This is not an elitist song. This is not for the soldier. This is not for the president only. This is for everybody.
Scher says America the Beautiful is not so much an alternative national anthem as simply a song of joy. Lynn Scher is author of America the Beautiful, the stirring true story of our nation's favorite song. Adam Phillips, VOA News, New York.
Thanks, everyone, for joining us today on The Voice of America on America's birthday, 238th birthday. Anytime you're on our website at voanews.com, we invite you to check under the Programs tab for International Edition. There you'll find podcasts of this very program. For our director, Tracy Carter, and engineer, Zarat Abu-Zaid, I'm Steve Norman in Washington. We hope you have a great Friday. Now a bit more of Ray Charles singing America the Beautiful.
When I was in school, we used to sing it something like this. Listen here. Oh, beautiful, far spacious skies, far amber waves of grain, far purple mountain majesties. Above the fruited plain. Well, now, wait a minute. I'm talking about America, sweet America. You know, God done shed his grace on thee.
This is Today in History. On July 4th, 1776, in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, the Continental Congress proclaimed the independence of the American colonies from Britain. The Declaration of Independence, drafted primarily by Virginia delegate Thomas Jefferson, presented a long list of grievances providing the rationale for the rebellion.
We hold these truths to be self-evident, that all men are created equal, but they are endowed by their Creator with certain unalienable rights, that among these are life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness.
Thomas Jefferson and fellow delegate John Adams, who served on the committee charged with drafting the Declaration of Independence, both went on to become U.S. presidents. Adams the second president, Jefferson the third. Coincidentally, both men died on this day in 1826, the 50th anniversary of the historic document they helped to create. In 1862, Lewis Carroll told a story to Alice Liddell that would evolve into the classic book Alice's Adventures in Wonderland. On this date, 3 years later, in 1865, that book was published. In 1950, Radio Free Europe conducted its first experimental broadcast in the Czech language. In 1998, Japan launched a probe to Mars and thus joined the United States and Russia as space exploring nations. In 2012, scientists at the world's biggest atom smasher in Geneva hailed the discovery of the Higgs boson particle, the so-called missing cornerstone of physics. Well, that's it for today. I'm Dave DeForest with Today in History.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Barack Obama has requested an additional $500 million from Congress to train and equip appropriately vetted elements of the moderate Syrian opposition. For years, moderate Syrian forces have been facing a Hydra-headed enemy. The Assad regime, which has used chemical weapons and barrel bombs against Syrian civilians, fighters supplied by Assad's ally, Iran, and Islamist terrorists like the Islamic State of Iraq and the Levant, or ISIL, which recently announced the formation of a caliphate in areas it has forcibly seized in Syria and Iraq. The Al-Qaeda offshoot, so brutal in its methods that it has supposedly been renounced by Al-Qaeda, is known for summary executions, including beheadings and crucifixions, of those it deems opponents or infidels. In a statement, U.S. National Security Council spokesperson Caitlin Hayden said that the additional $500 million President Obama has requested for the moderate Syrian opposition would help defend the Syrian people, stabilize areas under opposition control, facilitate the provision of essential services, counter terrorist threats, and promote conditions for a negotiated settlement. This funding, she added, will enable the Department of Defense to increase our support to vetted elements of the armed opposition. The $500 million request to train and equip the moderate Syrian opposition is part of a larger $5 billion request by President Obama for a new counterterrorism fund, $1.5 billion of which will be used to help Syria's neighbors, including Turkey, Jordan, and Iraq, secure their borders and assist the millions of Syrian refugees who have fled Syria. National Security Council spokesperson Hayden said the United States continues to believe that while there is no military solution to the crisis in Syria and that the United States should not put American troops into combat in Syria, this request marks another step toward helping the Syrian people defend themselves against regime attacks, push back against the growing number of extremists like ISIL who find safe haven in chaos, and take their future into their own hands by enhancing security and stability at local levels.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government. If you have a comment, please write to Editorials, VOA, Washington, D.C., 20237, USA. You may also comment and view all our current editorials at the VOA Editorials homepage, www.voanews.com/editorials.